This podcast is sponsored by an unrestricted educational grant from Medtronic. This episode is accredited for continuing medical education by CineMed. Please view the accreditation information in the show notes. After listening to the episode, click the link provided in the accreditation portion of the show notes to obtain your CME. It is with great pleasure that I am introducing our next guest on Reset Diabesity, Dr. Anthony Gonzalez. Dr. Anthony Gonzalez is the Chief of Surgery for Baptist Hospital. He had previously served as Vice Chief of Surgery. He is the Chairman of the Medical Surgical Performance Improvement Collaborative at Baptist Hospital and also serves as the Chair on various boards and steering committees. Dr. Gonzalez is the Medical Director of Bariatric Surgery at South Miami Hospital, and he is a member of multiple professional societies, including the American Society of Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery. Dr. Gonzalez's charity work and professional reputation have drawn surgeons from throughout Central and South America to travel to South Florida to learn from his expertise in bariatric and laparoscopic surgery. Dr. Gonzalez serves as the medical director for the Living Hope Haiti Christian Mission and performs pro bono surgeries in Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica. Dr. Gonzalez, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm wondering if a few times I think mentioned the notion of 5 years post-surgery as what sounds like a milestone, and a milestone in one's metabolic journey. Is there a particular reason for 5 years?
Because as a center of excellence through the Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery Quality Initiative by the American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery and the American College of Surgeons, which is a joint initiative. When you are a center of excellence designated by them, you have to show that you are following patients for a minimum of 5 years. And so the 5 years really comes from the fact that if a patient is successful at 5 years, they're likely going to be successful long-term. The most difficult years for patients are year 2, 3, 4. Those are the most difficult years. First year is easy. I describe to patients, that's the honeymoon. You get married, you go on a honeymoon, everything's beautiful. The work doesn't happen until you get back from the honeymoon and you move in, you're living together, and the struggles begin. And that's what happens at year 2, 3, 4. Usually at year 4 or 5, if you figured it out and your weight is stable and your vitamin levels are good, you've gotten the routine, you understand the eating habits, you understand the exercise requirements, you understand all that. If at year 5, 4 or 5, you haven't figured it out, your vitamins are not all over the place, you're probably not even showing up for appointments, you've regained your weight, then you figured it out the other way. You figured it out that it's been a failure. So yeah, I mean, it does take a couple of years for you to kind of get used to this and really engrave in your mind and in your heart the behavior that's required to have long-term success.
I'm wondering, this is just personal interest, is there any kind of secret sauce to, I find myself making the occasional bad choice, and that might be partially purposeful, and it might be just a result of, if I don't have a little chocolate, I'm going to lose my mind. Do your patients struggle with that?
No doubt about it. I always compare obesity or an addiction to food to an addiction to alcohol or drugs, right? You don't need alcohol to survive. You don't need smoking to survive. You don't need drugs to survive, but you need to eat to survive, right? So it's a very difficult addiction, right? Because I can tell you to stop smoking and smoking is zero. But if I told you only have one cigarette a week, but stop smoking, that is difficult because I'm teasing you along the way. And so first of all, you have to understand that obesity is a very difficult, if you want to call it an addiction, it's a very difficult addiction because you have to continue to eat to survive. On the other hand, I tell patients, don't become an extremist, because trying to adopt a behavior that is not able to be followed long-term is going to be unsuccessful. Right. So the best example is those Biggest Losers or the shows of people where they do extreme diets, the very ultra low caloric diets, or these competitions. Those are not sustainable long-term. Exercising three times a day and living on 500 calories, you could do that in the short term, but it's not sustainable, right? And so because of that, you have to do something that's sustainable. On occasion, having a piece of chocolate, on occasion, rewarding yourself for doing good and exercising and behaving 90% of the time, it's not going to kill you. I can tell you, my personal trainer tells me, have you ever seen an obese person get skinny on eating one salad? No. You're not going to get fat on eating one piece of pizza, right? So it's not one thing. It's the constant, chronic thing. So no, I think that don't try to be an extremist. I always tell the patients, don't try to be, you know, never eat a piece of chocolate, never have a dessert, never have a piece of pizza. You know, you're not going to be able to live that way the rest of your life. You have to kind of have a balance, but you have to understand you have this chronic condition that requires care, requires attention, just like a diabetic requires that type of care and attention. You have to follow it along and be good the majority of the time so that you could be successful long term.
I really appreciate that personally. It's that's very, very relieving. It's also really great. I feel like there's a lot of clarity here that, you know, if I, in the past, going to a primary care when the recommended course of action was simply lose weight and eat better, it's very hard to make sense out of that, those utterances, other than, okay, in the abstract, I agree with you, but what do we do about it? That's seems a very much more difficult proposition. What do we do about this? And this feels like, in my experience, this has been a success, and your patients, this has been a success. Do you see other treatments becoming available in the future, new surgical procedures, new opportunities to help people with obesity?
Yeah, I've had a lot of joy in seeing the onset of these GLP-1 agonists, you know, the Ozempics and the Wegovys. That's been phenomenal for our patients who don't qualify for bariatric surgery, those that are struggling after bariatric surgery, and those who have regained 20 pounds and come to me for a revision, 20, 30 pounds, and they're not candidates for revisions. They don't need a revision. They just need to go back and, you know, eat correctly and exercise. And so I love that. I would love to see more medications on the horizon. And then in regard to surgical procedures, I mean, it all comes down to the stomach. Could there be better, less invasive operations to be done on the stomach to control the behavior? Remember, it's a change in behavior. So these operations are done on the stomach or on the intestines to change the patient's behavior. So can we move to more of an endoscopic procedure, something through the mouth? Could there be devices implanted in patients to try to control behavior? One thing that has never been kind of solved is, you know, we know that there's part of obesity is in the brain and the reward center and the drive to eat in the brain. Could there be something in the brain done? Could there be, you know, an implant, a surgical procedure, a radial therapy or something, a radio frequency ablation of something in the brain to help with that? So those are areas that, you know, have not been, you know, successful, that maybe whether it be endoscopically or addressing the brain per se could possibly be solutions in the future.
Well, this is a great entree into the robotic side of surgery. This surgical innovation is interesting to me, and potential treatments are interesting. Let's talk about robotic surgery. What drew you to that?
Well, what drew me to robotic surgery was a bariatric surgery. Vertical banded gastroplasties are an operation that was obsolete, that was becoming obsolete in our community. There was one surgeon that had done 20 years of open vertical banded gastroplasties in our community. And those patients have failure rates in the upwards of 65%. And so he was sending me these patients to get converted to a gastric bypass because he didn't do gastric bypasses. And he wasn't interested in converting those patients. At that same time, I was doing laparoscopic gastric bypasses, but trying to convert an open vertical banded gastroplasty to a laparoscopic gastric bypass was very difficult. Laparoscopy just didn't have the technology, didn't have the ability to do that. And so I embarked on robotic surgery because of the improved visualization, the improved instrumentation, and I began to do those conversions. And I noticed that the robot, wow, what a great tool. It had superior ability over laparoscopy. And that's what was brought me into the world of robotic surgery. And the moment I adopted robotic surgery for primary bariatric surgery and for revisional bariatric surgery, I noticed, what about adding it to foregut? What about adding it to ventral hernia? What about adding it to colorectal? And little by little, over the last, 15 years, I've added it to other areas of my practice to either benefit the patient or benefit myself as the surgeon, making the operation easier for me, which at the end benefits the patient as well. So that has been, you know, the impetus for me to really, really, you know, kind of adopt robotic surgery into my practice.
I saw from a 2014 paper and from a 2015 paper that you did on single site and multi-site robotic procedures, one around cholecystectomy. And the other one was sleeve gastrectomy. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about those publications. I found them to be very interesting.
Yeah, so when we began in robotic surgery with bariatric surgery, sleeve gastrectomy became popular, and we were doing robotic gastric bypasses. So we started doing sleeve gastrectomies, and we started looking at our outcomes. And we noticed with our initial experience with sleeve gastrectomy, the outcomes were better. We took it against and compared it against a cohort in the published literature. We matched our patients with regard to BMI and comorbidities to a group in the literature and showed better outcomes. And, you know, probably had to do with the technology in the robot, technology of visualization, technology of stapling and so forth. So that was something that, you know, kind of as well, you know, motivated others to explore whether there were improvements in robotic surgery. In regard to cholecystectomy, there was a big push to do what we call scarless surgery, single site surgery, surgery that you could do through the umbilicus and hide the scar. And the robotic company Intuitive had produced a single site platform, and we adopted it. And we were the principal investigators for 5 sites around the country. And we collaborated, I think, 465 cases. And we looked at the outcomes and showed that single site surgery was possible. And I think 98% of the patients were completed through a scarless approach. And the outcomes were great. You know, no major complications, no bleeding, no bile duct injuries, nothing that was, you know, catastrophic for the patient. And again, demonstrating that robotic approach could be possible, was safe, was feasible in these procedures and in these patient populations.
Is there I don't know the data about around this, but I'm wondering if my assumption, probably wrong, is that infection is a big part of the problem post surgery. It also seems to me that there are mechanical things that can go wrong in the procedure on the wrong anatomical item, the procedure occurs with some error. Do you see a difference in those kind of error rates with robots versus robotic surgical procedures versus laparoscopic, traditional laparoscopic?
See, when you're talking about an infection occurs because something happens, a failure of the procedure, right? So let's give you a simple procedure like a sleeve. The reason a sleeve gets infected is A, there's a leak. And if there's a leak, that means that the stapler's failed. So if you have today in robotic surgery, you have a stapler that measures the thickness of the tissue and tells you that the staples that you're applying are the appropriate staples for that thickness, you would assume that you're going to get better outcomes. And so that's the level of technology that would eventually lead to less infections, less bleeding. Bleeding is another reason why you can have an infection, because blood is a very good nidus, a very good ground for bacteria to grow in. So if you don't have the right stapling, you have the advanced energy to seal the blood vessels, all of those would be issues in regard to decreasing infection in a patient. So yeah, I mean, it's the technology that leads to a better operation that in turn leads to less complications for the patient.
Are you seeing that? What are your peers' adoptions of robotic procedures? Are your peers keeping up with you? You seem to be pretty far ahead of other folks in this area.
Yeah, I'm at least 10, 15 years ahead of everybody else because, you know, I began in 2008, 2009 with robotic surgery. But thankfully, it depends on the area. You know, if you talk about something like hernia surgery, that's growing very rapidly in regard to the adoption of robots in hernia surgery, inguinal hernia, ventral hernia, bariatric surgery, to the benefit of the patient. Laparoscopy has made great strides. So now there's better instrumentation in laparoscopy. There's better visualization in laparoscopy, better stapling in laparoscopy, but there has been growth in the robotic bariatric world as well. But no doubt that, you know, I do 100% of our bariatric surgical programs on the robot. That's not what you're seeing nationwide. Probably nationwide, it's below 50%.
What do you suppose the reluctance is for folks to adopt this, the technology?
Well, I think part of the reluctance is that it's possible to be done laparoscopically. The outcomes now are somewhat parallel laparoscopically and robotically because of the improvement of laparoscopic surgery and because the cost of the robot, there's a cost of care. So, you know, you really have to show a dramatic benefit for you to kind of offset the cost of the robot. And so, you know, because of the improvements of laparoscopy and the because of the technical abilities of our surgeons, that really has benefited the patient. So, you know, do I think that every bariatric procedure needs to be done robotically? I don't think so. I think a procedure like a sleeve today, with the advancement of the laparoscopic technology, could be safely done and with great outcomes laparoscopically. No doubt we do bariatric surgery, there's going to be a benefit on the robot, and there are multiple studies that have demonstrated the benefit of robotic surgery in that cohort. But you know, I think maybe the simpler procedures can be done, still be done laparoscopically.
As with your medical director hat on, is there a significant cost difference, I guess, over time, amateurized over time, between the robot and between laparoscopic?
Yeah, so you depends on how you looked at cost. Okay. When we look at cost, we look at the cost of what is occurring in a case. And so we don't factor in the cost of the robot itself. The hospital believes that the cost of the robot is like the cost of doing business. It's the cost of buying a CAT scanner. You need to have a CAT scanner. You need to have an X-ray machine. You need to have certain things just to do the business. And so when you look at the cost of a particular procedure, the cost of stapling, the cost of the energy, the cost of the drapes, all of that, those operations are really cost neutral. Where people, you know, kind of can't get beyond the vision is when they try to factor in the cost of the robot itself, that, you know, we don't need a robot. But see, you need a robot for urology because it's necessary to do a prostate robotically. You can't be doing prostates laparoscopically. It's not possible. And open is not standard. You need the robot for thoracic surgery. You need the robot for gynecologic and gynecologic oncology. You know, you need the robot for a lot of hernia, right? So you already have the robot there. It doesn't cost you more to use the robot on Tuesday than it did on Monday and Wednesday. If nobody's using it on Tuesday, then use it for the bariatric procedure and possibly have better outcomes in your patients. So, you know, I think that's what people can't get beyond seeing. And that's would really, really, you know, benefit their programs if they can kind of structure that into more multidisciplinary robotic program.
And that's a function, ultimately, that's a function of doing business. This is a piece of hospital equipment in the same way that an MRI is a piece of hospital equipment, that you don't expect each radiologist to factor it into a series of tests. It's just standard procedure for the hospital to have that technology.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. That's what, the way we look at it. But not everybody looks at it that way. They take the cost of the robot and divide it into a number of years and so forth. But yeah.
And as you expand the number of procedures that you can do with the robot, then presumably it won't be sitting idle at any point in time.
Right. And a resource, the better utilization of a resource, you know, the better it's going to be. And there is a value in doing robotic surgery. We have demonstrated not only, you know, you look at cost always at one way to look at cost is what it costs you to do a procedure. But the other way to look at cost is, what is the benefit of doing this procedure? If you can get the patient out of the hospital a day sooner, if you can avoid a complication, if you can avoid a conversion to an open procedure, which increases your operative time, increases your length of stay, that's what we call a cost avoidance. And there, you're saving money. That's what we saw in our institution. We were able to send hysterectomies home sooner, thoracic cases home sooner. And if you're able to do that, you know, as a hospital, you get paid for a diagnosis and a procedure and a DRG. If the patient spends 21 days in the hospital, you don't get a payment for every day. You get a payment for if they spend one day or 21 days. And so getting them out of the hospital is cheaper. And so if you can do that, it's going to be more cost effective to you.
I do want to ask you, when if you were to talk to a room full of primary care, and in this case, I'll include endocrinologists, I'll include orthopedists, cardiologists. If you were to talk to them about your patient is presented with comorbidities, also your patient is obese, what would you tell them to help them get to you or get to another bariatric center of excellence?
I would ask the primary physician, the orthopedic surgeon, the cardiologist, I would ask them to discuss with their patient, is the obesity a problem for you? I mean, it's a problem for me as the orthopedic surgeon because I can't do your hip or knee replacement until you've lost this weight. So if you want to get your hip or knee, you need to lose the weight. And if you want to lose this amount of weight, you probably should be seeing a bariatric surgeon. Ask the primary physician, the cardiologist, one of our biggest referrers. You know, no doubt obesity creates a bigger strain on the heart. And no doubt that mortality, cardiovascular mortality, is much higher, much younger in the obese population. We know that they lose, you know, around 8 to 13 years of life loss because of the obesity. So as a cardiologist, if you can express that to your patient, if you can educate your patient about the morbidity of obesity on their cardiovascular health, then you can converse with them and convince them that, hey, you maybe see a bariatric surgeon. And then lastly, with a primary physician, you know, hey, you're coming to me because you got back pain. You're coming to me because your blood pressure is out of control. You're coming to me because your cholesterol is out of whack. Well, you know, if you want to deal with all these problems, if you have bariatric surgery, we can deal with all these problems with one operation. So, you know, I think that's the kind of, you know, conversation each individual specialty has to have with their patient, endocrinologist. You know, I mean, you can't get the blood sugar under control. Yeah, you know, if you have a gastric bypass, I mean, one of the best operations for metabolic syndrome, I will help either control, resolve, you know, your metabolic syndrome, your diabetes.
I wonder if I guess I want to talk a little bit about the sort of standard quality of care, what you envision as a standard quality of care for obese patients in the future. Are you there now, or do you have something aspirational you would like to do?
Well, I mean, we're at the standard quality of care of what we have now, but I mean, I think that we have to kind of come out of our offices and our clinics. And I think standard quality of care will be, you know, almost virtually visiting with the patient on an ongoing basis, where the patients could be checking in on their weight. Could we have sensors, you know, developed that can check on their vitamin levels and on their protein levels? I think that could be the future of standard of quality of care, where, you know, they don't have to be disturbed to come to an office to be weighed and to be checking their blood periodically. That's something that could be done on an ongoing basis remotely, and it could be done periodically to a patient. Something be checked at home, so simple and so inexpensive that anybody and everybody could afford it in their house. A scale that, you know, can check their weight, their BMI, but also maybe protein and vitamin levels as well. And that would be, you know, sent to us electronically or wirelessly. And so we could check in on patients, and then we'll have better compliance. If the patient's not doing well, then we can get in contact with them. We can send them support. We can communicate and connect them with nutritionists, dietitians, mental health providers, something. But you have to make it easier for the patient to be compliant, because compliance is a big, big issue. That is the number one reason for failure.
Speaking of that, I think that's an interesting segue to AI. Have you thought about AI in your practice, about how you might integrate it into the business? And that's either as a medical director or as the chief of surgery. Have you thought about the sort of this explosion of, and not just large language models and generative, you know, like open chat and open AI, but machine learning in general, AI in general, any of those technologies?
Yes, I've been working with the Intuitive, as well as with some of the up and coming robotic companies, because that's been a focus of theirs, especially the newer companies, of machine learning, so that it would guide other less experienced surgeons in doing procedures. I think that's something we've been working with for probably in the upwards of 5 years at least. And I think that's very, very important, because the more information you have, even for someone like me who's done 30 years of bariatric surgery, the more information you have, the better you're going to be. The more experience you have, the better you're going to be. And so, you know, that type of machine learning and guiding, when you're at a crossroad in a surgical procedure and not knowing what to do, a machine suggesting, you know, what the last 100,000 million other, you know, alternatives have been and what the outcomes have been, would be very, very important. And in the office setting as well, if you run into a post-operative complication or post-operative issue with a patient, as well, if all of that could be put into a machine and kind of organized, where you have a patient with a particular outcome, what is currently the best way to deal with that patient? What is the information today? It's like published literature, but at the moment, right? It takes a long time to get published experience out to the peer review for you as a surgeon or as a practitioner to learn from it. If you had that, and you know, on a daily basis, and populated into some type of data bank, and on an ongoing basis interpreted, that would be phenomenal for the care of patients. It would be lack of delay in best practices for a patient.
And I guess that brings us to the performance improvement part of what you're working on with your center of excellence. That is part of the mandate, is focus on performance improvement.
Yeah, as a center of excellence by the MBSAQIP, we have to produce at least one quality improvement project per year. I can tell you we are reviewed every 3 years, and we have 5 or 6 projects that we present to our site reviewer. Why? Because there are areas that you can improve on. I'll just, right now, we're looking at how to improve patient follow-up. You know, we're having an issue of patients showing up to appointments, despite the fact that we call them, we email them, and we send certified letters. Patient compliance is an issue. So we're trying to improve on that. We're trying to improve on post-operative bleeding. Bleeding will occur. If you're giving patients anticoagulation after surgery and you're doing surgery, bleeding is going to occur. And so how can we decrease the amount of bleeding post-operatively in patients? You know, we want to get to zero harm, no harm to a patient. Obviously, we're doing bariatric surgery to benefit a patient, but there's a risk with everything you do. The greater risk is to have a pulmonary embolism, a blood clot. So we give blood thinners and anticoagulation to prevent that, but we don't want bleeding either. So it's always looking at how to improve the care we're providing patients. Is there anything we can do to improve that care, whether it be the quality of care, the patient experience, the patient follow-up, or the perioperative complications that the patients are experiencing?
How many programs are like that? How many out there can do this?
Well, in our country, I think there's just short of 1,000 MBSA QIP centers of excellence. So, as a certified center of excellence, you have to, you know, have a quality improvement program per year, one project per year. So, you know, we would assume that everybody is looking at their program and trying to improve on it. I don't think that primary physicians really want to manage diabetes and high blood pressure their entire life. I don't think that they want to be struggling with obesity. I think it just requires acceptance and time from the primary physician to spend a little bit of time and effort and talk with the patient and explain to them, hey, you know, you may be a candidate for bariatric surgery. It's going to solve your diabetes, your high blood pressure, your high cholesterolemia, your metabolic syndrome as a whole. Metabolic and bariatric surgery is safe. You know, the complications are just like removing a gallbladder or doing a hernia repair. So it just requires a little bit of effort from the primary physician. And then it also requires acceptance from the patient. You know, patients a lot of times will shut them down immediately and say, absolutely not, I'm not doing that, and so forth. And so, you know, it brings a bit of frustration to the primary physician. But I think it's both the primary physician, spending a few minutes in doing that and the patient accepting it and accepting the recommendations. Listen, I had a patient the other day, came to me. I said, do you have high cholesterol? Yes. And are you taking medication? No, I won't take the medication. Why? Oh, because these statins, they cause muscle pains and I'm not taking the medication. I said, but that was prescribed? Yes. So patients at times, the primary physician prescribes something, recommends it, and the patient can't even accept the medication, let alone accept bariatric surgery recommendations. So, you know, it's a two-way street. I really don't envy the work of a primary physician and the struggles they have, you know, with these patients dealing with all the problems that they have. I only have to deal with one problem, you know, obesity or a hernia or a colon problem, but, you know, they're dealing with all their problems.
The open procedures tended to be riskier, I gather, and that there was early in the bariatric surgery's history, there were it was a relatively more risky procedure than it is today. Do you think that has affected people's perception of the procedure as over time? That it's how aware are they that it's gotten this much better?
No doubt about it. And not only the open procedure, but the instrumentation, the technology, the stapling devices, all of that was more antiquated than it is today. And today's technology makes things much, much safer. Obviously that has impacted our, let's say, the more senior primary physicians who have been around as long as me and have know that history and have that in the back of their mind and may not be familiar with the advancements of laparoscopic surgery, robotic surgery, enhanced recovery after surgery. You know, these patients are drinking a few hours after surgery. These patients are walking in the hallways a few hours after surgery. There are programs that send their sleeve patients home same day. Gastric bypasses go home the next day. We used to keep our gastric bypasses 4 or 5 days because of the morbidity of the operation. So that may be, you know, a lot of what is not known and limiting, you know, primary physicians' acceptance to bariatric surgery for their patients.
Is there anything you're between your medical director hat and your chief of surgery hat? Is there anything you're doing research on now that is really exciting to you? Is there any new ground that you're looking to discover here?
In the world of bariatric surgery, we're actually looking at what we call the smart stapling of the robot. And we're collecting all of that data because we have a few years of stapling using the robotic stapling and determining whether that's going to be better than what's out there laparoscopically. As I described to you, we have a stapler that now measures the thickness of the tissue and will tell you that it's correct stapler or incorrect. And does that translate into better outcomes? We know that the outcomes laparoscopically are great. So you need a big N, you need a large number of patients to be able to show a demonstrated difference. And so we're looking at that in bariatric surgery. And then we're also looking at it in non-bariatric surgery. We're doing a study for gallbladder patients that come in, you know, acute cholecystitis that come in through the ER, and we're enrolling them in laparoscopic versus robotic cholecystectomy and determining the outcomes of that as well. So that is, you know, a couple of great projects of many that I work on because we have a very robust research team that are looking at, you know, outcomes in these patients.
What does that research team look like?
The research team is led by myself as well as a research administrator who has a doctorate degree and who's leading the team. We have statisticians. We have research coordinators. We have administrators who are involved in the oversight and helping us in regard to getting things through the IRB. We have budgetary people because we do a lot of stuff that is sponsored through industry, putting together the budgets and so forth. We have a lot of medical students and other students who are doing the data collection. And then I have research fellows that help as well. So it's a well-rounded team of different individuals that each have their role to accomplish the goal of trying to advance the knowledge and the science of surgery in our areas of specialty.
Have you found that NIH has been an active participant in funding the research, or is it mostly industry?
Well, the NIH does, but you have to have a very, very big project. We are working on some smaller projects that eventually could lead to NIH funding. We're working on a particular project in regard to ethnic disparities in regard to bariatric surgery and cancer risk. So we have a large cancer center. We've been doing bariatric surgery for 25, 30 years. Is there a ethnic disparity? Is there a Hispanic disparity in regard to bariatric surgery and cancer risk? And we know that cancer risk is reduced after bariatric surgery. And so is that still the case in Hispanics? Is it similar? Is there, what about which cancers? And that's something that the NIH is interested in, but we don't have the team yet to be, maybe go to the NIH, but we're going to start with smaller projects, and eventually our goal will be that. A lot of patients come to me. That is the preponderance probably of the patients. They come to me without their doctor's involvement because they are looking at it themselves. Maybe their doctor, as we mentioned, had not discussed it with them, has not taken the time to discuss it with them. And so a lot of patients will come to me without their doctor's involvement. But to the primary physicians, if you're interested in referring to your local bariatric surgeons, simple as going on the ASMBS website, the American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery, and you could search your area for a bariatric surgeon through the ASMBS. And that is our national society, international society. And if the bariatric surgeon's listed there, it tells you what their experience is. Are they a member? What procedures they do? How many years of experience they've had? So there you can, connect with a bariatric surgeon and say, hey, I didn't know that you did bariatric surgery, or I have a need for a bariatric surgeon. And that would be on the other side as a primary physician, trying to help your patient find a bariatric surgeon if your patient does, had not found one themselves.
Dr. Gonzalez, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for answering our questions, for interacting with us. I really, really appreciate it. I appreciate what you're doing, and I really hope to help inform providers about your practice and what's available.
No, thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the interesting questions and the conversation. I think we've covered quite a bit in this time period in trying to educate our healthcare professionals about what's available for their patients and how to deal with these comorbidities and the underlying condition of obesity. And really just trying to bring patients to a happier and healthier life for sure.
Thank you. Thank you for spending your time tuning into this episode of Reset Diabesity. I hope that you found it to be of use in your continuing diabesity education. This episode is accredited for continuing medical education by CINEMED. Please view the accreditation information in the show notes. After listening to the episode, click the link provided in the accreditation portion of the show notes to obtain your CME. Please feel free to send us questions, comments, or show ideas you may have for future Reset Diabesity episodes. I'm your host, Dr. Rob Johnston. Thank you for listening. This podcast is sponsored by an unrestricted educational grant from Medtronic. The content of this podcast includes opinions of the participants and are not to be construed as medical advice. Always consult your own physician for medical guidance.